I'm Jordan Myers.
I mean, this is just bullshit.
Well, no, that's a bunch of bullshit.
This is bullshit.
Well, that's very nice bullshit, Rip.
You know what? That's bullshit.
And you're listening to That's BS. Before we begin today, I just wanted to kind of make a proposition to you. If you listen to this episode in part or in its entirety, and you learn something that you didn't know before, or your mind has changed on something, consider giving us just $1 a month on Patreon. That would cost you actually $12 a year. And if everyone did that, it would help us to cover the costs of this podcast. I'm actually paying money right now to create this, which I love doing, don't get me wrong. But it would be nice if I could get out of the red. So that's my proposition to you. You can take it or not. But if you listen to this episode and you learn something or your mind was changed, well then just consider going to our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/thatsbs. And of course, you'll be rewarded for your donation as well. Thanks for listening, and here's the episode. All right, welcome to That's BS. I'm Jordan Myers, and today I have Jason Crawford with me. Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So, like I said right before we started recording, I'm looking forward to this as really an education in progress studies largely, but kind of a scientific and data-driven approach to progress. So before we delve into that, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and what we're about to talk about?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Jason Crawford, and I'm the author of a blog called The Roots of Progress, where I write about the history of industry and technology, and more generally, the story of human progress, how we got here, why everything took so long, and how we can keep human progress going and, you know, maybe even accelerate it.
Mm-hmm. So before we really get into all of that, firstly, how do you actually define what progress is? Because it seems intuitive, but maybe there's more to actually defining it than people realize.
Yeah, I define progress by a humanistic standard. So much as described by Steven Pinker in his book Enlightenment Now, it's essentially the standard of human life, happiness, health, thriving, and flourishing. And I think of it in three main categories. Technological progress, or more broadly, economic progress, creating more wealth, more ability to deal with the physical world. Two, scientific progress, or more broadly, progress in the growth of knowledge and our understanding of the world. And then three, progress in government and society, how we treat each other, how we get along, more peace and freedom, basically.
Yeah. How did you get started in, because I think you self-describe yourself as obsessed with progress at large. How did you stumble into this?
Yeah, so I've been doing this for almost 3 years now. Began as a personal project where I simply wanted to revisit and re-examine what I was coming to see as the foundations of my worldview. I came to realize that a lot of how I see the world, my philosophy, and even my politics was based on a keen appreciation for the story of human progress, how far we've come, how much it sucked to live just a few hundred years ago, right? How much living standards have increased in that time, and how really almost all the progress that we enjoy in all three of those areas I mentioned, technology, science, and government, has really come about in just the last few hundred years, even though humans have been around and we've had, you know, language and societies for tens of thousands of years. So it's really kind of the last 1% of what they call behaviorally modern humans that almost all of the progress has occurred. And so I started to see this as kind of foundational to what I consider to be important in the world. I think this is the most amazing story ever. And one of the most, if you care about human life and happiness and health, it's one of the most important things to understand. How did we get to this point we're at that's so much better than where we came from? So I started to read about it, and it began as just my personal reading, and then it became a blog. And then, as I said, I got a little obsessed with it, and now this feels like one of the most important things I could be working on.
Yeah, I like you kind of mentioned, it's almost the story of all stories, because progress is sort of the thing that makes everything else possible in a certain sense. Like we're talking to each other across the United States via Skype. And even 30 years ago, that wasn't really possible. So there seems to be, and I think you hit on this, a sort of exponentiating trend in progress, because, you know, if you lived 100,000 years ago or 120,000 years ago, there was almost no change that was noticeable. But less than 20 years now gives you a hugely different perspective. So what, in your view, were the main drivers, and why did it take us so long to actually get to a point where the slope of that progress graph was positive?
Yeah, I don't think I have a full answer to that question because I'm still researching. I'm still telling the story of human progress and just getting the outline, the overview. But I think there are, you know, some clear factors that almost everybody agrees on. So one thing, for what it's worth, is that progress is a process that builds on itself. So it's a self-reinforcing cycle. Different components of the industrial world reinforce each other. When we can, you know, manufacture things better, for instance, we have better ways of making metals. That gives us better ways of making vehicles like trains or ships. That in turn gives us better ways of transporting raw materials and finished products. New technologies to make, in the Industrial Revolution, there was kind of a reinforcing cycle between coal, steel, trains, and the steam engine and steam power in general. Mm-hmm. And, all four of those things pretty much reinforced each other and reinforced themselves. So you get these reinforcing cycles. You also get them between the areas that I mentioned. So science and technology reinforce each other. The more science we have, the better we understand the world, the better we can create new technology. And better technology, in turn, helps us advance science. In fact, a lot of scientific advances didn't come about until certain instruments were invented. You know, everything from the microscope to LIGO, the huge machine that was recently constructed to look for gravitational waves. Yes. And then I think, too, there are cycles within those things and government and society. Ultimately, I think, more wealth and production and trade has spurred the evolution of our government and society, and better rule of law, better protection of rights and so forth has created the environment in which we can do science and develop economic productive capacity. So you would expect all of these things to build on each other in an upward sloping curve. But I think that when you look at the history, you find that there's something more to it going on than a simple exponential. In fact, if you try to graph key metrics, you'll find that it's not a simple exponential curve that goes back for thousands of years. There was a knee in the curve. The rate of improvement, even in percentage terms, increased around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And so I think there was something fundamental that we figured out, something at the level of culture or even philosophy around the time of the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, new ways of looking at the world, of experimenting, of getting at truth, discarding authority, and really the very idea that we can and should make progress itself is a relatively new idea. So I got this realization deeply from a book that I read. The first book that I read in this project was titled A Culture of Growth. Just came out a few years ago by an economic historian named Joel Mokyr. And he argues that the idea of progress is not natural, and we didn't actually have the idea for most of human history. Most societies practiced what Mokyr calls ancestor worship, the idea that our ancient ancestors were the greatest people who ever lived, that we will never surpass their achievements, and that indeed all knowledge that matters was revealed to them in ancient times, and all we can do is try to learn from the texts that they left to us. So this view broke down in the West, in Europe, between roughly Columbus and Newton, Mokyr says, so about the 1500s and 1600s. Today we have not a cyclic view of history, but a view of history as an upward progression. And something where we can make progress, we can learn more than our ancestors ever knew, we can invent better things than they ever had. But that idea only came about a few hundred years ago. And so I think that was a crucial component.
So I guess I don't know anything about this subject, but it doesn't seem to me like there was anything really preventing progress before it happened, right? Like there wasn't a change in the weather or anything that drove it. So was it sheer accident that it tended to happen, you know, at the age of the Earth that it did? Like, why did it take humans 100 or 200,000 years to get to the inflection point of progress, like you mentioned, between, you know, the Industrial Revolution and Columbus, basically? Is that sheer luck that it didn't happen sooner? And is it sheer luck that we're still not, you know, nomads living on a plane somewhere?
It's a good question. So to rewind, since you're talking about, you know, things in geological time scales, hominins, you know, species that were roughly human-like have been around for millions of years. You may have heard of ancient ancestors of ours like Homo habilis or the Neanderthals. Species like that go back for millions of years, and they were using stone tools for millions of years. The controlled use of fire happened somewhere in the last million years, some hundreds of thousands of years ago. But that was about all we had up until, certainly up until the dawn of our species, which is our species Homo sapiens is about 200,000 to 300,000 years old. And even Homo sapiens really just kind of had stone tools and fire and not much else until about 50 to 70,000 years ago. So sometime around then, you got what is referred to maybe as the cognitive revolution or the beginning of, quote, behaviorally modern humans. It is thought perhaps or hypothesized to coincide with the beginning of language. And it seems to coincide with the beginning of art and religion. So there seems to be some point at which our species either evolved the capacity for or simply began to use higher level conceptual functioning. Again, about 50 to 70,000 years ago or so, based on the latest research that I've seen. Now, again, for so at that point, we did start to develop some slightly more sophisticated things. We had more sophisticated stone tools that they began to specialize stone tools for different purposes. We began to make things out of bone. There are, you know, animal skin clothing that we could sew together with bone and, you know, needles. At some point, we made small boats and could travel, you know, short distances by water. Probably evolved a lot of hunting techniques, etc. But we were still nomads wandering in tribes and bands and hunting and foraging up until about 10,000 years ago. So, you know, at least 40,000 years and maybe longer of even after we evolved language and thought, we were just kind of, yeah, hunting and gathering. And it was roughly 10,000 years ago, give or take, that you got the beginning of agriculture and of settled societies, people actually settling down in one area. Exactly which of those came first, we're not certain. Used to think that sort of agriculture led to settled societies. Maybe it was the other way around. I won't get too deep into that research. But that's around the time when you start to get, as well, crafts, such as you know, pottery, kilning of limestone. Eventually, you get you know, weaving and metalworking and so forth, right? So thousands of years ago, you get the beginning of the Bronze Age and then later the Iron Age. So, you know, why did it take so long? Why were we wandering around for 40,000 years? You know, I think there's a few things. So one, again, nobody had the explicit concept of progress, right? The concept of invention, the concept of science, none of these things existed. Right. If you if all that you know and all that you have ever seen is a sort of day to day, you know, and maybe season to season kind of struggle for survival, then why would it ever occur to you to, you know, go? I mean, maybe you're going to experience if you're a real inventive genius, maybe you would experiment with better ways of carving stone or whittling wood or something. And they did that. Right. But you're. And maybe you would even look up at the stars, and if you were a real mathematical genius, you would wonder about the patterns in, you know, and maybe you would try to find patterns. But you didn't even have writing at that point. So even if you discovered something, you couldn't write it down. the only thing you could pass on was through speaking and through artifacts that you could leave to people, right? You could show people new practices, perhaps, right? But if you discovered some amazing pattern in the sky, you know, you're it's going to be hard to even pass on any kind of scientific knowledge, even if you were the lone genius who could come up with that, right?
Yeah.
Writing itself, by the way, didn't even evolve until about 5,000 years ago.
Wow.
So such a blink of an eye. So that was part of the reason, I think, why there was virtually no progress during that time. You know, the other part was... So a couple of more sort of practical or, you know, economic factors. One, if you don't have a lot of surplus, you don't have a lot of time to spend tinkering, right? If you have to be, if you have to spend time every single day hunting and foraging and so forth, right, you you may not have a lot of time for long-term projects. And this is crucial. If you were... because it's debated exactly how much leisure time hunter-gatherers had. It's been said that hunter-gatherers actually maybe had more leisure time than early agriculturalists. I haven't delved into the research on that yet. But perhaps more importantly, a lot of the things that we think about in terms of invention or experimentation or scientific discovery, a lot of them require settling down because they require you to have artifacts. So if you're a nomadic tribe and you're wandering around, you can't have a lot of stuff, right? You got to take everything you own with you. And by the way, if you have small children, you have to carry them as well, right? So you don't have a lot of, like, you can't make you're not going to make a kiln for pottery or limestone or a furnace for smelting iron when you're constantly on the move. So perhaps we had to settle down first. And of course, these nomadic tribes had no idea that settling down and settle into permanent settled societies was going to eventually give their distant ancestors in the descendants in the future of these amazing benefits, right? So why would they have ever have done that? Mm-hmm. So we might have needed an accident of history for people to settle down and actually create these settled societies in order to even develop the crafts. And then many thousands of years later, it evolved into the society that we have today.
That's sort of crazy to think that it may have been an accident of history. Do you think it was an inevitable accident, or are we really lucky to have a civilization at all?
You know, I mean, you could argue that we're lucky to have a multicellular life on this planet, or life at all for that matter.
Yeah.
Right? Given how many planets we've found that don't even have that, or we don't think so. So, you know, there are a lot of accidents and a lot of luck in history. And then there are other things where, given a certain confluence of factors, a certain outcome was inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Do you, I guess we're sort of painting a fairly rosy picture of progress. But what are maybe some of the things that have derailed or at least deterred or delayed progress during certain periods of history?
Sure. There have definitely been those. I mean, the most famous perhaps is the fall of Greek civilization and then later the fall of the Roman Empire. And, you know, the period that is called with some dispute, but I think legitimately referred to as the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. So certainly in Europe, other civilizations maybe had less up and down, but certainly in Europe, there was a whole period of, you know, hundreds of years, maybe arguably 1,000 years, where we were set back and didn't make much progress or had to claw our way, you know, back from that.
Mm-hmm.
So it can certainly happen. And again, you know, a significant part of what happened there was cultural forces. You know, the ideas of, you know, the ideas of ancient Greece were very different from the ideas of Rome, which were very different from the ideas of the Christian, you know, Dark Ages and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess there's also kind of the flip side of that coin is maybe the kind of deleterious effects that progress itself produces in a way. And I guess maybe one that comes to mind, two that come to mind maybe are, you know, the fact that with industrialization came pollution and you know things that spurred climate change, and also wealth inequality, where if you look at I think this was kind of the driving thesis in Charles Murray's book, The Bell Curve, where, like, you know, you kind of mentioned, if you look at, you know, someone who was three standard deviations above the average IQ, but they lived in 50,000 BC, well, then, you know, they could gather maybe a little bit more than someone else, but they couldn't do anything with that IQ. And now they can start a software company and, you know, amass billions of dollars while, you know, their next door neighbor could be living in squalor. So what do you think about the, I guess, potential downsides of progress itself? Because that seems counterintuitive also.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, progress is not a simple linear progression. It's not monotonic. It's a messy process. And there are, it definitely entails risks. Just ask the early scientists who experimented with x-rays or radiation, right? Ask the people who, the construction workers who died from improperly handled explosives before we learned safer handling practices. Or for that matter, you know, the people who, building the Panama Canal, who died from tropical diseases before we learned how to conquer them. There are, you know, so there are, and we explore things, we find things that work, we find things that don't, we find things that work, but we didn't realize they had bad side effects and so forth. And so we always have to be on the lookout for new problems that we've created when we solve old ones. And, you know, the evolution of safety technology is an important theme right alongside the evolution of every other type of technology. But I think there's a few important things to keep in mind when you think about progress at a high level this way. So one is just that the fact that a new technology or technique, let's say, creates new problems is not an indictment of the technology. What you have to look at is whether the new problems it created were better or worse than the old ones that it solved. Usually the new problems are better to have. I mean, as a simple but huge example, most of the problem with food throughout most of human history was getting enough of it. Famine was common. Today, we have conquered that problem so well in almost all of the world, right, with a few exceptions, that the problem today is obesity, right? Food is so abundant and consistent and reliable and delicious, we have to restrain ourselves from eating too much or the wrong kinds. So that is a problem, but it's a good problem to have. David Deutsch writes in his book, The Beginning of Infinity, that this is the pattern of all problems, that solving problems always creates new problems, and that's not a bad thing. It's just the nature of problem solving. That's one of the meanings of infinity in the title of the book, is that there's an infinity of problems to be solved. We're never going to run out of problems. The only way to run out of problems is to die. and if you're lucky, you will never run out of problems, and you'll just keep solving new and better ones. I think of it like an expanding frontier where we keep solving problems, and then we keep sort of opening up a frontier of new problems. Just as with knowledge and science, whenever we answer a question, it opens up new questions. The fact that a scientific theory leads us to ask new questions or points out new things we don't understand is not an indictment of the theory. That's just how science works. And the fact that a technological solution created new problems is not an indictment in itself of the technology. It's just how technology works. Mm-hmm. Another thing I think you have to keep in mind is that just the record of human progress on balance is just so amazingly, overwhelmingly positive. You can point out problems, but if you just look at any of the metrics, you know, almost any one of the dozens or hundreds of metrics you could come up with and that people have come up with to measure human well-being, they're almost all on like a very strong increase. You can see these at the website Our World in Data, which is dedicated to collecting these and showing them off. You can also find many of them in Steven Pinker's book Enlightenment Now, which is dedicated to showing just how much progress we've made and a bit of where it came from. You know, child mortality and maternal mortality way down, life expectancy way up. Even things like pollution, the human environment, the environment that we actually live in, like local pollution is actually, our environment is actually way cleaner than it used to be. So pollution has actually always been with us. We've just been making And yes, we have come up with new forms of it, but there have always been old forms of it. You know, we used to have human sewage running through the streets before we had sewer systems. And we had horses, you know, doing their business in the streets before we had automobiles. We had people literally burning wood indoors before we had electric or gas stoves and central heating systems, right? In fact, this is still a problem in poor parts of the world that can't afford modern, that don't have modern energy systems. They burn wood and other, you know, quote unquote biofuels indoors, and it creates indoor air pollution, smoke indoors that people that is a serious health problem. And this used to be everyone. So yes, it's true that why we, you know, at certain times in history when we have ramped up certain factors of production, such as in England, we started burning a lot more wood and coal, and it led to soot everywhere. But eventually, we solve those problems. More wealth, more technology, and just more kind of ability to even care about those problems allows us to attack them and clean up our environment, which we've been progressively doing more and more over the course of history.
Yeah, which I don't think any of that is to say that problems can't be, I don't want to say unsolvable, but at least very dangerous, and the imperative is there that we should solve them, right? Like, just to guard against that interpretation.
Oh, certainly. And our, you know, and our species has faced existential threats before, and we've come about them. Everything from, it's believed from, I believe, genetic evidence that our species once was reduced to a very small number of individuals, maybe in the time when most of us were still in Africa on the savannah. All the way to in the late 1800s, the world was facing a fertilizer crisis. We were rapidly running out of natural fertilizers, and it could be seen that we were heading for a kind of Malthusian catastrophe where we literally could not grow enough food to feed everyone. And we got out of that one by inventing the Haber-Bosch process, which gave us ultimately gave us synthetic fertilizer. So yes, huge problems can be created. They need to be taken seriously. And then we need to attack them with all of the same tools that got us to where we are and go further. The solution to the problems created by progress is more and further progress.
Yeah, it is a kind of an iterative game in that way, which I guess, is far better than the alternative games we could play, which are to, I guess, like you said, worship our ancestors, right? That's the only other option, really.
Yes, and to keep essentially doing the same things that we have always done in static fashion until something in our environment changes, which it always does, and we cannot cope. And that's the problem with trying to avoid problems by keeping everything the same, is that you can't keep everything the same. Eventually, your environment will change, whether that's, our prehistoric ancestors who could be wiped out by a flood or a drought, especially if they're, or a frost if their crops failed, right? All the way up to some of our distant future ancestors who eventually will need to leave this planet, if only because the sun is going to consume it in about a billion years. So.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if that was the reason why we had to leave Earth first, but I guess.
I hope we leave Earth. You know, if for no other reason, purely to explore and look around and for a bit of variety before the billion years is up. But
yeah. Actually, on that note, is there any evidence that supports whether progress more often comes from necessity or abundance? Like, is it?
Yes, it's a good question. Sure. I think. Both, but basically, I think from the way you're asking the question, the answer is abundance. And not just that, but the fact is that necessity is always there. Human needs are always around. Needs do not by themselves cause you or certainly force you to invent solutions to them. People can just suffer along with problems for an extremely long time. Abundance seems to be a more relevant factor because abundance or surplus gives people time and space to experiment and invent and explore. And that's how we actually find new things. The needs are always there. Abundance alone does not do it. It's not the only factor. But it's more of a factor than necessity.
Mm-hmm.
That said, occasionally, you know, knowledge of particular necessities can direct human research and development efforts at particular problems. So again, when the fertilizer crisis was was imminent, that directed people's attention at that problem. During wartime, a lot of energy and effort is redirected at war problems, and that's why radar was developed during World War II. So it certainly can, you know, when we see a particular need, it can point us in a direction. But it doesn't. I don't think it really a particular need doesn't necessarily increase the kind of amount of exploration that we're doing. That more happens from economic factors such as surplus and cultural factors around, you know, how we think about and whether we care about innovation itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you think are the, I guess, most preeminent kind of hangovers from our past? And I kind of ask that wondering if you think that maybe, you know, things like religious adherence or this kind of wistfulness for the good old days, or maybe, you know, tyranny, things like that are the most dangerous and long-lasting hangovers of previous ages.
Yeah. I mean, I think for millennia, the biggest, some of the biggest blockers in that sense were tradition and authority.
Hmm.
Tradition in the sense of this is the way we've always done things, and authority in the sense of looking to someone as a source of knowledge. And that someone could be a king, it could be the Pope, it could also be a scholar of the past. So, you know, very famously, Aristotle left the world with writings on many different subjects, including physics. In the Middle Ages, many people took his writings as a kind of authority, which was not even the spirit in which he left them to future generations, but it was the spirit that they were, you know, taken by people who came, a couple thousand years later. And, that kind of attitude, I think sometimes Aristotle himself is blamed for this. There's a similar thing. I'm in the middle of a book right now about the history of the medicine and particularly the germ theory. Mm. And Galen, for instance, was a Roman doctor and writer on medicine who promoted a previous theory of the theory of the four humors, the idea that problems in the body come from an imbalance of fluids. There were fluids like blood and bile and so forth. Completely wrong theory of of disease. But again, Galen was taken as an authority, and people just sort of accepted everything he had to say, including about anatomy, since they weren't doing autopsies on humans. So they had limited ability to learn a lot about anatomy. So that kind of that looking to authority to gain knowledge is one of the things that we overcame with the scientific revolution. The motto of, I think it was the Royal Society, was in Latin, in nullius verba, which roughly translates to on no one's word, or don't take anybody's word for it, right? Mm-hmm. So it was the transitioning, and this also is in Machir's book, Culture of Growth. It was the transitioning from an authority-based, you know, view of knowledge to one where people were on a more equal footing, and it was reality and experiment that was kind of the ultimate arbiter, right? So it was looking to facts and to observation to gain knowledge. So I think that was a huge one. Now, once we had, in the more modern age, and especially with the Enlightenment and kind of the age of reason, I think a bigger blocker to progress perhaps has been the kind of the romantic counter-Enlightenment. So almost as soon as the Enlightenment came about, there were thinkers who were reacting against it, calling for us to go, you know, back to nature, or praising the noble savage, a la Rousseau. And I think you still see strains of this throughout the whole 19th and 20th century. And I think even into today, a good part, certainly not all, but a lot of the anti-technology or anti-progress movement comes from a sort of romanticist back to the past, looking on the past as a golden age, fearful of technology, fearful of knowledge and progress, fearful of the future, you know, that sort of attitude.
Mm-hmm. And you could even, I think there would be a pretty plausible case that you could say that a lot of these sort of these movements towards subjectivity being valued over objectivity is another version of that, you know, where people say, I guess it has to do with identity politics and intersectionality and just valuing the subjective whim in some cases of an individual over what we sort of know as a scientific community to be the case. That it doesn't seem to be in the same strain as what you mentioned, but it seems to be kind of maybe the next permutation of it.
I agree. Yeah, and I'm not one thing I'd like to study more is the development of that strain of thought and those ideas. But I agree that anything that that places feelings or subjective thoughts over facts and a common, you know, universal reality and reason is going to have that effect.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar at all with Michel Foucault, but he. Now, I think a lot of people, myself included, probably don't understand him fully, but he seemed to push back towards the Enlightenment era of reason in a way that is a bit different from that. He seemed to push back against it by cautioning us not to elevate reason to its own godlike status, just as we had elevated, you know, God to a godlike status before that. Do you think that that's a danger that we are likely to fall into, or is that really not our biggest concern?
I'm trying to think of what it would even mean to elevate reason to godlike status.
Yeah.
you know, if after all, I mean, what is, if you understand, what do you understand reason to mean and how do you apply it? Mm. I think you could... I'm trying to come up with the most charitable interpretation of that idea I can. So mm-hmm. here is an example of something perhaps you should not do, and that I think some people do is they look at science or worse they look at particular narrow fields of science in a kind of narrow way, and they take the epistemological methods of those fields mm-hmm. As the standard that should then apply to everything. So the idea that we must be able to do controlled experiments, or that everything needs to be able to be described by mathematical laws, as in physics, or everything needs to have a randomized controlled clinical trial, as in medicine. And then, you know, I think there's a mistake to think that we can't get to any certain knowledge unless it comes through those sorts of methods. I think every field of knowledge has its own, you know, sort of set of methods that are appropriate to the context of the field, all different ways to apply reason. But, you know, if you understand reason in a more general way of this is applying thinking and logic to ultimately to observation of reality and, you know, seeking to identify reality and truth. Based on observation, reason, and logic, I have a hard time seeing how you could go too far with that, or elevate that to, you know, to too high of a status. If that becomes our new quote unquote God, I think we're in a pretty good place.
Yeah, it is kind of a paradox because it'd be sort of unreasonable to elevate reason to a God's position. It does sort of bite its own tail in that sense.
I think, though, that is a type of argument that people make when they're trying to tear reason down or put it on equal footing with faith or subjective feeling. Right? They say, "Oh, you reason is just as good as faith because you have to have faith in reason." No, that's not. I don't think that argument holds up.
No, it's a bit of an oxymoron. You have this interesting blog post that suggests that studying progress is in itself sort of a moral imperative. What did you mean by that?
Yes, I think progress itself is a moral imperative in that it has done such wonders for humanity. Again, just looking at how far we've come in the last few hundred years. When you look at the charts that I mentioned, mm-hmm. any chart of human progress in any dimension, or really more to the point, all of them put together. Again, if you love human life and health and happiness and flourishing, you can't help but look at that and think, wow, we've got to keep this going. I mean, here's the perspective on it. If you look back at where people were just a couple hundred years ago, they thought and they felt that they had life pretty good, and they did in their context. But today we are so much better off. We are we're incredibly wealthy compared to that time. Conversely, what that means is those people living just a couple hundred years ago were desperately poor compared to where we are today. And if you look at that and realize that that can keep going, then at a certain point you realize that our future descendants are going to be fabulously rich compared to where we are today if we do keep this going. And conversely, by that perspective, we ourselves are in a sense desperately poor compared to that future that we can and should be in a few hundred years from now. Now, if you got thrown back in time to the colonial era, knowing what you know today, you would fight with every ounce of your being to scramble out of that one way or another and get back to what we enjoy today. Mm-hmm. And I think by the same token, we today should be fighting as hard as we can to get out of the relative poverty of today and into the amazing future of tomorrow. But I think most people don't have that perspective, and that is part of the perspective I want to give to people. Not so that we can all commiserate with each other and feel sorry for ourselves for living in this terrible time. That's not the feeling that I want people to have. But I do want people to have that feeling of a huge goal in front of us, a much better time and place that we can get to, and to feel that drive and that inspiration to work hard to make that future a reality.
Mm-hmm. You have another blog post that has this pretty funny section of a paragraph. I just want to read it and then get you to elaborate on it if you could. You said, quote, "I recently met a self-described progress skeptic and asked, when you think of differences in the standard of living between 1700 and today, what comes to mind? She could only come up with one example, even when pressed: improved medicine. So no awareness that famine, once common, has been virtually eradicated. No awareness that the manual labor we save by having machines to wash our clothes and vacuum our floors." You go on and on. And, you say that she has basically no appreciation for the ease and the efficiency and the really just excellence that she experiences every day wasn't always like that and didn't necessarily have to be like that. And you say that it's interesting that people don't really find this something that's imperative to know, or they don't feel any shame that they don't know it. And, this podcast has been sort of an exercise for me to alleviate that a bit of that ignorance in myself. But why do you think that people, I mean, it's true. I you really don't think about that on a daily basis. And most people don't seem to ever really reflect on that. I mean, why is that?
Yeah. It's funny. You think, many people maybe aren't good at math, and they'll sheepishly admit that they don't, they're not quote unquote math people. Mm-hmm. That's a separate mistake, not really related to this. But they say that, right? Maybe they've never read any classic literature or don't really get Shakespeare, and they'll kind of sheepishly admit that. But if you brought up something like, "Hey, by the way, do you know what industrial process involving, extremely high pressure chemistry in large furnaces is basically responsible for keeping half of humanity alive by producing enough fertilizer to grow enough food to feed all of us?" People just treat it as like a trivia question. Like, "Oh, geez, nope, I don't know. Gosh, what's that?" Right? And even if you tell them, they might say, "Nice to know." And then they'll forget it the next day. And it won't occur to them that something so crucial to the life of every human being ought to be like part of their basic education. And I think this is just, this is just something about the culture that I think we need to change, right? People don't, this is not even a subject in school. Think about it. It falls between the cracks of history and science classes. History, you learn a lot about wars and social movements and, things like that. science, you learn, well, you know, actually, hopefully you learn actual science. but there is no, like, history of technology class or, like, here's how industrial civilization works or, you know, here's the basics of the system that provides you with your standard of living. Like, you just, there is no, we don't even have a name for that, right?
No, I mean, yeah.
I'm having to use phrases now to describe it. In fact, until a few months ago, when this term progress studies was coined in an article in The Atlantic by Tyler Cowen and Patrick Collison, we didn't even have the term progress studies to name what I and a number of other people are doing or interested in. And in fact, we didn't even know about each other because there wasn't a word for it and there wasn't a place we could all go to talk about it. You know, I think that's, again, it's just, why do we not think about this? It's just not part of the culture. It's not taught in schools. You don't hear about this kind of stuff in the news media, you know, which has a strong negativity bias. Mm. You don't really get it in popular culture, which is increasingly dystopian in recent decades. And there's not a great source to, if you just want to learn about it on your own, I think there's a very limited set of places where you can learn very much about it. I have not been able to find a good one-volume summary of the Industrial Revolution, written for the layman. I'm not sure that it exists. And that to me is a shocking fact, given the importance, you know, that we've been discussing of that period and that phenomenon to humanity.
Yeah. And there is this weird sort of imbalance, really inverse relationship between how likely people are to devote their attention to a subject and how important that subject is. Like, you know, you'll have like endless TV stations dedicated to just, you know, like the Keeping Up with the Kardashians or whatever that show is. But, you know, a book written by Steven Pinker on the Industrial Revolution will get what, an order of magnitude less people who buy that book than will watch a show about, you know, some dysfunctional family. So it does. Sure. Yeah, it is. It is sort of an indictment on the average person's use of their attention, really. And it's sort of interesting that the luxury that they have to not pay attention to these things is actually caused by the very nature of those improvements themselves.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, and I would like for every sort of educated person to have a basic grounding in how the industrial world works. I think it's even more important for kind of the subset of folks who are the leaders of the world, the people who run companies, people in government, people in academia, sort of the leaders both in thought and in action, who, you know, ultimately determine the kind of the course of our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I want to be mindful of your time, but before we go, I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you for what was truly an education in this area. And I look forward to reading the rest of your blog posts. I thought they were very entertaining, the ones that I read in preparation for this, and very informative and very hopeful in a time, like you said, which is fairly dystopian. So why don't you tell people where they can find more about you and your work and see this progress for themselves?
Yeah, that's right. So the blog is called The Roots of Progress. The website is rootsofprogress.org. And you can also follow on Twitter, Roots of Progress, or there's a Facebook page as well.
Awesome. All right, Jason, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks. This has been a great conversation. Lots of fun. You asked some very good and philosophical questions.
If you listen to this episode in part or in its entirety, and you learn something that you didn't know before, or your mind has changed on something, consider giving us just $1 a month on Patreon. That would cost you actually $12 a year. And if everyone did that, it would help us to cover the costs of this podcast. I'm actually paying money right now to create this, which I love doing, don't get me wrong, but it would be nice if I could get out of the red. So that's my proposition to you. You can take it or not, but if you listen to this episode and you learned something or your mind was changed, well then just consider going to our Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/thatsBS. And of course, you'll be rewarded for your donation as well.